rock star isn't just the person on stage. It's like, how much are you going to bring it when you go into that meeting? How much confidence are you going to walk in with? Whether you're feeling confident or not, it's like you walk in with confidence like you're a rock star, and people believe it, and then you start to believe it.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is world-class drummer and motivational speaker, Mark Shulman. Mark has played with rock and roll royalty, manning the drum share for everyone from Billy Idol, Foreigner, Sheryl Crow, Cher, Stevie Nicks, Beyonce, and many other familiar names. He's also done four world tours with Pink over the course of 15 years. Mark has also been presenting keynote addresses to corporate clients over the years, and his current presentation, Hacking the Rockstar Attitude, is a huge hit with companies like Dell, Genentech, IBM, Citi, Cisco, Walmart, and many others. During the interview, we talked about how his hearing loss affected both his drumming and communication and what he did to overcome it, a fantastic story about auditioning for Cher, making the transition to motivational speaker, his unique outlook on life, and much more. Mark also appeared in the podcast way back on episode 51. I spoke with him from his home in Venice, California. You know where I want to start, though, is a place where I think most musicians don't want to go, and you've gone there seemingly fearlessly, which is hearing problems. So when did
yes.
you first start to notice that?
I noticed that I had tinnitus from 15 years old on. And the interesting thing is I've always been pretty fastidious about protecting my hearing, even as a teenager, because I had such bad tinnitus. So I would have to cram some sort of earplugs, or I'd wet tissue or do whatever I could do, because if I ever played with a band, even as a teenager, if I played one song without hearing protection, my ears would ring so badly. So I got used to really protecting my hearing. But over the course of, you know, when I started getting into, you know, my 50s and stuff, I started realizing, you know, I'm really having a lot of trouble, more trouble than most people, even though I've been really conscientious about protecting my hearing. And I even have molded in-ears when I'm on stage, and they're sealed very tightly, and I try to keep the volume down. I still notice that when I'm out, in particular, when I was in restaurants and such, I was having a lot of trouble understanding people. And I finally went to an audiologist and had my hearing checked, and I was shocked. I was essentially deaf. You know, the hearing spectrum, you know, we hear primarily from 2K to 8K. At 4K, I had lost 60 dB,
ooh,
which is basically deaf. And but it had happened so gradually that I just had no idea. And that's substantial hearing loss, and it's unusual hearing loss. But remember, that's exactly where the snare drum is and where the click track is. So I've been playing drums, and still, even though I've been wearing in-ears, it's still probably a lot louder than I had thought. So I have no qualms talking about it. I mean, I think that people, I even, you know, scold students if they don't wear hearing protection. I'm really adamant about people being very, very careful. My grandma was hard of hearing from a very, very young age. So I grew up with her, you know, wearing hearing aids, and, you know, her speech was impeded as a result. And so I've been very conscientious about it. But finally, I just couldn't believe it when I finally got hearing aids. And then these new Widex, the Widex RIC or the Widex RIC, are incredible because they're so intelligent, because they have, like, you know, like a microcomputer and four microphones inside, so that my hearing will actually adapt to different environments. And it's so wild. It's like you don't know what you're missing until you know what you're missing. And I'll never forget when I first got the hearing aids in my bathroom, put on the hearing aids, and all of a sudden I could hear birds chirping outside that I had never even heard. I didn't even know they were there. Take the hearing aids out, they don't exist. So I was almost emotional for me when I realized how this has, you know, enhanced my life. This augmentation of my hearing has really enhanced my life.
One of the things that I saw in the press materials that were sent to me about that I didn't know about was the connection between dementia and hearing loss.
Oh, yeah. And that really freaked me out because both of my parents had dementia. And when I read the stats, I remember the stat. The stat says that 9.3% of the dementia patients had hearing loss. That was one of the number one causes of dementia. And my brother is in his 60s and has dementia already. So I'm very conscious. That's another reason why I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to wear these hearing aids like as much as I possibly can. And the challenge I have is sometimes I can't wear them because like when I'm on planes, as an example, I'll wear like, you know, my AirPods because I put them on, you know, blocking out on sound cancellation. So I'm blocking out, you know, what people also don't realize is driving an airplane, it's just the constant, you know, rumble of something that really is stressful on your hearing. So I just try to wear earplugs or sound cancellation whenever I can. And when I'm doing my speeches, I'm wearing my molded in-ears because I'm actually performing. So I'm not able to wear my hearing aids, but I wear the hearing aids whenever I can, because obviously, as I said, I want to be able to get every single nuance, and I can adjust everything. I can adjust for different environments, and it really works out great. So,
you know, we have that in common. I first got tinnitus when I was, I would say around 15 as well. So I've been living my whole life and, but successfully. I don't know that it's there until somebody mentions it or I read about it or something and I go, oh yeah, there it is. So I managed to deal with it. And the other thing is my mother also has dementia. She's 99. But what I noticed was as soon as her hearing got bad, that's when it started to kick in for her. So I personally saw the connection there. Anyway,
yeah.
Let's go to your transition from touring to a keynote speaker.
Well, I'd done probably 1,000 drum clinics in my day, and my parents were both professors. So when I did my first drum clinic in like 1991, and I got up in front of everybody, and I was so scared and so apprehensive, and I'd never had that experience before. Then I started realizing, wait a minute, this feels comfortable up here for me. And I realized that I could really sort of coach people and I could tell a lot of stories. And I found that people were, after a while, people were really resonating with the sort of stories of success and the coaching components as much as the drumming. And I was hanging out with a friend of mine who's since passed away, Dom Famulara, who's considered the ambassador of drumming. And Dom was telling me the story how he had done a corporate speaking gig because a guy had seen him. He was very, very motivational. A guy had seen him at a drum clinic and he just said, hey, can you just I got a small corporation. Can you just come and speak for my corporation? Do exactly what you did. And he said, I think we have only about $7,000. Will that do? And we're making like $500 doing a drum clinic. And so I thought about that for all these years. I thought, you know, that would be a fantastic platform for me because I've spoken for all these people. I have all these stories. I study philosophy. And I made a commitment. I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start really sort of molding what I do and increasing my skill set. I studied with a couple of speaking coaches, an acting coach, a director, a storyteller. And I just got my chops together. And I also started to really understand the needs of the corporate market because it's very different. When you're doing a drum clinic, you're telling stories and you're playing drums, you know, whereas when you're serving a corporate market or a corporate client, there are specific components and specific outcomes that they want to have and they want to see you bring. So I call what I do a rock show disguised as a keynote because I still play drums and I still, you know, perform with a lot of video, but even every drumming performance has content attached to it. So I gradually started getting collegiate gigs and some corporate gigs. At first, I joined a sort of an online agency, quote unquote, and I just built up my reputation. And I'm pretty gutsy. I started calling all of the speaking agents. We call them speakers bureaus, and they have agents. I started just cold calling the agents. And when I, by the time I did that, I was playing with Pink already, and I had pretty good opening line. I said, I'm the drummer for Pink, and I do this very high energy presentation that I do for the corporate market using music as a metaphor for productivity. I said, can I have 30 seconds of your time? And everybody said yes. And so I just really built it up and built it up and started doing more and more gigs and getting better at my craft and refining my craft and getting the reputation and making videos for people. And I'm not shy, so I'd promote. I'd be just calling people and calling clients and calling meeting planners. And before I knew it, I had built up quite a business. And I feel like this is a greater platform. It's a more purposeful platform. Because after touring for 32 years, I thought, well, I think that's enough. I think I want to make this evolution into sort of this new career that I've been cultivating for all this time. And so here I am. And it's been utterly fantastic. I just feel such a sense of satisfaction because I still play and I have my all-star band. So a lot of times I'll speak and, during the afternoon, and my all-star band will perform at night, and we'll have, guest artists like Mark McGrath, or Kelly Hansen from Foreigner, or Mickey Thomas, or Ann Wilson from Heart. So I still get to play, and I still do a lot of sessions, and I don't play as much as when I was on the road, admittedly, but I still get my share of playing, and I do love playing as part of what I do for the corporate market because they love it. They want somebody to bring in a different perspective. They want to be able to learn and get some content that's purposeful, but they want that perspective of somebody else. And drummers are the coolest people on the planet after all.
Of
So,
course. Yeah, right.
everybody knows that. As I'm staring at your bass on the wall, But drummers
Absolutely.
and bass players are best friends. So
I'm not a bass player, actually. It just happened to be in that position today. But anyway, one of the things that I, as a storyteller myself, when I do presentations, you tell a story and then you have to pivot to the point. And
Yeah.
when I watched you're so good at that. So let's go to your story about auditioning for Cher.
My story, auditioning for Cher. It's funny because I recently started telling that story again. I hadn't told that for a few years. But essentially, I could go down in the Guinness Book of World Records for the musician who's auditioned for Cher more than anybody else. I auditioned for Cher three times, but I'm not going to even talk about the first two times. I actually got the gig on the first audition, and then the gig was taken away from me because the old drummer showed up. Apparently, I don't know what it was. Somebody didn't want the old drummer to be there. He became a good friend of mine anyway. And then, anyway, come around to the third time. By the time I got to audition for Cher the third time, I changed my goal. I thought, I can't control the outcome, but I can control how I experience it. And I enjoy the people I met because I've actually had done auditions that I didn't get, but met great people and ended up working with them later on. So I thought, I'm going to make my goal to have the best time I possibly can and have everybody else have the best time they possibly can. And I came in and I found out that I was number 9 out of 10 drummers, and these poor sods had been around all day playing, "If I could turn back time," and "Do you believe in life after love?" And the last thing they wanted to hear was another damn drummer. So I show up and I'm just happy and I'm cracking jokes. They ain't buying it. They're just like zombies. They're like, "Let's just get through this thing. It's like another guy. It sounds just like everybody else. Let's face it, playing Cher songs is not brain surgery. It's not complicated. So what's going to set me apart?" So at the end, Paul Mirkovich, the MD, who ended up being the MD for Pink and Cher, and he's a good friend of mine, he says, "Okay, Mark, just play whatever you want. Just jam on whatever you want." I said, "Whatever I want, what do you guys want to play? You've been here all day." So I flipped the energy back to them. And Sam Sims, the bass player, got a little sparkle in his eye. And he starts playing "School Days" by Stanley Clarke. Remember that 70s fusion song? And I start jamming with him. And then Dave Barry, the guitar player, is also, I've known for years and years. And then Daryl Smith on keys, everybody joined in, Paul joined in. And then it happened. Everybody was smiling. And at that point, the energy completely shifted. It's the first time that we actually felt like a band. I actually felt like everybody was really listening and everybody really cared and they forgot about the goal of auditioning. And that was the point where, bam, I just knew that it was looking really good. Then I spent the next 20 years on and off playing with Cher. I played with Cher and Pink at the same time because it's the same manager. I was a younger man back then. You know, at one point I was playing with Billy Idol, Simple Minds, and Foreigner all at the same time. And I don't know how I navigated that, but I managed to navigate that. So that's my Cher story. It was really about redirecting, changing the goal and redirecting the energy back to everybody else, which obviously has a great corporate metaphor as well. So it's a wonderful thing to tell the corporate audience.
Well, that's my point, where you're telling your story, but there is a pivot that works for the room.
Now, absolutely.
I'm curious, if you tell that story in different situations to different audiences, would you change the ending, the pivot at all?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily change the ending, but I would attach a different bit of content to that, depending upon what the corporate audience wants. And my partner, Heather Kreider, she's my partner in life, and she's also my business partner. We've created a brand new program that is mind-blowing that we haven't even introduced yet, but we just did our first version of it. And it's called the Everyday Rockstar. And it's assessing people through four different pillars about how they can literally improve their communication, improve their productivity. So when I told the story, we just did an Everyday Rockstar keynote. As I said, it was the first one, and I told that story. And I related it back to the pillars of the Everyday Rockstar. And the basic pillars of that are self-awareness, your awareness of others and your communication with others, your ability to deal with your nerves and your ability to deal with how you deal with adversity and how resilient you are, and your guts, your courage, how much you bring it. And that is actually an acronym for SONG. And we had already talked about the Everyday Rockstar and the song. And I said, at that point, everybody was bringing their song. Because the concept of the rock star is one thing. And at a point in my life, I realized that there's something better and deeper than the rock star. I played for a billion people in my life, and that was the pinnacle of everything. But being the everyday rock star, bringing your song, having real self-awareness and awareness of others, and being very resilient in your ability to deal with adversity and your ability to really bring it with guts and courage. So I attached all that to that performance, the Cher audition story, to sort of bring the point home, because at that point, they were not bringing it. And these people are rock stars, have played for everybody and all the greatest artists on the planet, but they weren't bringing it until we actually started playing something. And then they were very self-aware. Then we were very aware of each other. Everybody was really listening at that point. And the adversity that they were facing about the auditioning just dropped completely. And everybody had guts. Everybody was playing full out. So it was such a great metaphor for bringing the everyday rock star, for bringing the song.
But, you know, that's why we do what we do, because when you get that energy, when you get that buy-in from everybody, it transcends the everyday life. It's something, and that's what keeps everybody doing it, despite how difficult it can be sometimes. So, yeah, and when you relay that to everyday life to other people that haven't experienced that, they can get it on some level, which I understand completely. It's very cool. If you're tired of your mixes coming out muddy, thin, or lifeless, I have great news. You can take the quality of your mixes from amateur to pro level using the techniques of the world's top mixers. I'll show you these quick solutions to 15 common mix problems with my Mix Fix playbook. Go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now.
Well, one of the things that I believe is that we all have rock star DNA. We all have our stage, quote unquote. You know, Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely performers. And it's really true. So whether you're on stage performing or whether you're, you know, giving a, you know, heading up a meeting at work or doing a pitch to a client, that's your stage. That's your performance. So everybody can relate to the metaphor of performance. And what I do is when I speak is I try to put the concept of you have your own sort of rock star DNA back in everybody's lap. And I actually have everybody stand up at one point and just throw their shoulders back and walk with swagger and channel their own whatever rock star they want, or think about a time when they really felt successful and confident, because that's what a rock star is. A rock star isn't just the person on stage. It's like how much are you gonna bring it when you go into that meeting? How much confidence are you gonna walk in with? You know, whether you're feeling confident or not, it's like you walk in with confidence like you're a rock star, and people believe it, and then you start to believe it. So it really is a matter of the mindset or the attitude. I mean, my book is called The Attitude Equation, my new book, and it's all about the fact that you can't control what happens to you so much of the time, but you always have the power to change, control, or shift your attitude. And you can choose that. And it's really critical because your attitude is what drives your behavior. Think about the power in that. And one attitude can drive many behaviors, and your behavior is what determines the consequences or outcomes of your life. It's A times B equals C. So Dr. Jim Samuels, who's been one of the mentors of my life, we co-wrote the book because that's actually Jim's acronym. And then what I did is I went and I interviewed rock star performers in all fields, everybody from Judd Apatow to Howie Mandel to Grant Cardone to Martina Navratilova, about their experience with attitude. And everybody told a story or multiple stories about how attitude, you know, informed their successes and their failures. So it really does begin with your attitude, and that's such a critical thing.
Okay, when you're giving a presentation, especially to corporate people now, I'm sure that you get some that buy in right away. But there are others that are stuffy corporate types. Do you do something special to get them involved? You notice that they're not buying in and you do something, you're playing to the crowd, essentially. Or is there a point that you know during your presentation, you know it's going to turn them around?
There is a certain point during the presentation. I don't want to give it away because I've literally structured my presentation, and Heather and I are structuring our presentation, you know, very meticulously, very nuanced. So it's also very emotional. I'm a cancer survivor, so I also tell that story. And I wasn't supposed to be able to father a child, and I've got a 14-year-old daughter who's a little miracle, and I tell that story. So, you know, the idea is we are moved by emotion. All the decisions we make, even if we think they're business decisions, quote unquote, we are still motivated by emotion. So I am certainly inspiring people to get emotional at various, very specific points with very specific nuances that have to do with attitudes that I talk about and attitude shifts that I demonstrate. And I know there's a point where there probably isn't a dry eye in the room. Whether you're, even if you're snobby, if they just put their phone down long enough to start to listen, everybody's buying in. If they're not buying into what I'm saying, they're digging. I play a Foreigner medley, I play a Pink medley, I play a Cher medley, I play a Billy Idol medley, I go in the audience and I pick on people for fun. I mean, it's people just get engaged because that's who I am, and they're really responding to my energy. I think what I get, which makes me feel, I mean, I'm very humbled by the whole thing. There's no ego attached to anything that I do. I feel like I'm just, you know, just the universe just comes through me, and I am just a conduit. I'm just was smart enough to recognize that I have that I could be the one to be the conduit. But it just really it becomes very, very emotional. And I become very, very emotional. And the comment that I get probably more than anything else is people go, "Wow, where do you get that energy?" And I don't know. I get on stage, I mean, I'm getting excited. I'm getting pretty energetic right now. And I'm on stage, it's like, that's five times what I'm doing right, who I am right now. Because I believe that the energy is really, people can feel the energy, and that motivates them.
Okay, you're a very high energy guy, obviously, and I know you're holding it down right now. That being said, let's go back to when you're playing. You have to control that energy to the song. You have to play dynamically. And I would imagine that would be really hard for somebody that has as much energy as you to know when to back off. Or over the years, I'm sure you learned that, but it's not a natural thing for someone that's very high energy.
My philosophy, and I tell a whole story, this is part of one of the buildups I talk about in my speech, is, you know, I tell a little story of Billy Idol. We were writing a song in my studio one day. He says, you know, mate, I used to get on stage. I used to sing every single note like it was the last note I would ever sing. And I thought, whoa, I hadn't thought about it that way. And I sort of morphed the story into the fact that every single note I play matters. Like every note, every word, every thought, every action. If you treat every note, every word, every thought, every action like it matters, you're attaching a sense of purpose to every note. So it makes doing the simplest, quietest beat have such definitive purpose. And the moment you attach purpose to every note, you become more passionate about that note. And the passion feeds the purpose, and the purpose feeds the passion. Because people are obsessed with passion, but passion is fleeting. Passion gets you there, purpose keeps you there. So purpose is the expansion of passion. And that's the way I approach it. So I could sit down for 5 minutes and not play a fill and just feel it and just know that every single note, every nuance, where I hit the drum, how I hit the drum, the dynamic levels of every note, every snare drum beat, every kick drum beat, it all matters. And I think that's what every great musician knows. And that's the difference between, you know, the top class performers in any field and the people that are in the middle. Because the people in the middle just aren't paying attention and aren't acknowledging the value of every single note, word, thought, and action.
I still love
that. You pay that much attention, you know? So that's what it is.
That's awesome.
That's the everyday rock star. That's the concept. That's what Heather and I have been developing. It's really true.
Let's come to your books. So you've written two of them, and you just mentioned your latest one. But I'm curious, and again, as an author who's done a lot of books, I know what it's like. You write the first one, and you go, I'm never going to do that again. A lot of brain cells die in the process, and it takes some prodding to go on and do another one. So did that happen with you as well?
You know, not so much, because I the second, in both books, I interviewed a lot of people. So it was fun for me. Mm-hmm. In my second book, I interview like, you know, 8 or 10 of the top drummers, you know, Kenny Aronoff and Matt Sorum and Antonio Sanchez and Greg Bissonette and Rich Redman. I mean, you know, the list goes on. That was part of what I want. I just was part of my own personal things. I'm going to get the drummers' perspectives as well. But I enjoyed the process because I enjoyed the process of interviewing people. But the difference in the first book and the second book is the first book, Conquering Life Stage Fright, has just little snippets of interviews to support the content. Whereas the second book, The Attitude Equation, is the interview and then the content supports the interview. So there are just things to look out for at the beginning. We had a great editor, Jesse, edited both books, Jesse States, but she, you know, has the readers what to look out for in this interview. And at the end of the interview, a list of questions on how you can take that information and use that to enhance your own life. What you just read that Judd Apatow talked about, the stories that he tells. And, you know, we learn from stories. So people love to hear stories.
One of the things I noticed was you never really know somebody until you interview them. Tell me if this happened to you as well. So I've had friends that I've known forever, and yet I get them on an interview and I go, I didn't know that. You never told me that. Did that happen to you too?
Yeah, that happened with the people that I knew, certainly, like, you know, some of the drummers, because you start hearing stories or philosophies that you had never discussed as friends. So there's always something new that you learn. And yeah, I agree with you. The interview process is can be really profound. And some people were more closed than others, surprisingly. So I found that fascinating. So my expectations, some of the people were just incredibly open and incredibly articulate, incredibly expansive with their communication. And some of the people that I thought were going to be more open and, you know, and really, really deep, didn't go as deep as I had hoped.
Yeah. Sometimes that could be just the day you caught them on too.
Oh, of course. Of course. It's just that for me, because of my own personal philosophy, if I'm going to do anything or be anywhere, I play full out. I'm the everyday rock star.
Okay, so when did you come up with that? Not that concept so much, but the fact that the development of your philosophy of life. When did it dawn on you, well, this is what I have to do?
A lot of it began with, I talked about my mentor, Dr. Jim, who co-wrote the book, because I met him when I was 22. And he was teaching classes and he had a lot of amazing philosophies. And we did a lot of inner work, sort of looking at what the root of stresses and bothers and inhibitions. And I became very philosophical and I just have started realizing that there is so much information and so much to learn and so many ways to expand and so much to give. You know, at a point in my life, I realized truly everything that I do really is to be of service. And if you approach your life that way, whether it's a conversation with my daughter or playing drums for a client or doing an interview for you, I'm here to be of service. And it just gives a deeper meaning and a deeper purpose to everything.
Yeah.
And I think that that really shifted my attitude a lot. But understanding, you know, for years and years, this ABC formula I've known, understanding that attitude really is the foundation of everything. It's not just what you do, it's who you are. And when you embrace that and you realize that you have power and control over that attitude, then it's really wonderful. And truly, you can be a better being. You can live your best self and affect everybody else around you more positively. And that's just how I like to live my life.
So you learned that as a fairly young man. And that's, you know, I'm not sure if a lucky break is the way to put it, but it's fortuitous that you learned that early, where I think that kind of wisdom comes to people a lot later in life normally.
Well, I did. I learned that early as a result of the teachings and then studying a lot of other people, you know, the Wayne Dyers and anybody I could get my hands on, Tony Robbins stuff. But I think that we kind of come into this life with certain proclivities of who and certain tendencies of who we are. I mean, my daughter, I feel like, has had the same personality since she had a personality. And I think that I've had the same sort of lightness of being that I am my whole life. You know, we kind of come in, I believe it's like a 50-50. It's 50 nature and 50 nurture. So, you know, we come in with this certain amount of personality traits and physicality and intelligence and however you want to measure or quantify it. And then the other 50% would be the influences and what's nurtured in you. So, you know, my parents had their issues, but my parents were, you know, good-hearted people and people that cared about education, people that cared about being ethical, had integrity. My definition of integrity is you just do what you say you're going to do just because you said you're going to do it. Just keep your agreements, keep your commitments. So I did have, you know, a really, really lovely folks. My dad was a very angry man, but he wasn't a mean man. So he had his own issues with anger. So he was always yelling. My friends were scared to death of him, but he had a good heart. So that's what I gained from him, was the understanding that it really is about your heart and not always about how you express it, but what's at the core of who you are.
Very cool. Last question, Mark. And thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking.
Of course. Thank you. great questions.
Pleasure, for sure.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful to chat with you again.
What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
I do think that the understanding of the power of attitude is probably the most potent bit of information that I've learned in my life. It has had probably the greatest influence, that I do have the ability to change or control or shift my attitude, and regardless of what happens to me, and regardless of what anybody says to me, the truth is that we're meaning-making machines, I heard somewhere. It's the meaning that you attach to something that is your interpretation, and that's attitude. So you could say whatever you want to say to me, and the meaning that I attach to it is what I walk away with, and that determines kind of who I'm being. So attitude really is so foundational. And on a different day, I might give you a different answer, but that's what comes up right now because we're talking so much about it. But I truly believe that I just pay a lot of attention. And if you're paying a lot of attention to who you are and who you want to be and how much service you can provide for others, and then life becomes richer. And you have more, you're just, I'm attaching more meaning to things and the nuances. And Heather has been instrumental. I now meditate every day just about being mindful, really being present. Like every morning, even though we live in different cities, I walk out on my balcony and we have our coffee and we toast and we just get mindful. It's like just this moment right now, because the truth is all we have is now. I even coined a phrase, life is a series of nows. Because the past really doesn't exist. And the way you live your life now, you're living into your future, so to speak. So the more present you are, you can really just savor and be a conduit for the greatest experiences for yourself and for others.
I do hope that all that you just said is in your book. And if it's not, then you have an opening for another one.
There'll be another one. I promise.
That was excellent. Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, man.
This is great. I quite enjoyed speaking with you again. I'm so glad that we had a chance to do it. And I hope we can do it again in the future.
Thank you, Bobby. Oh, we will. Let's just do it every few years. Keep everybody updated on what we're doing and who we are.
Yeah, I'm down.
And how we're evolving. Evolution is really critical. And I'm really grateful for the time, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Cheers. Take care.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.